At the Races with Steve Bick. Enough! Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back at the races, hour three on this Monday. And for those of you that thought that the Derby memories ended last week because, you know, the dates went into double digits. Well, how can it be the first Saturday in May? Well, they didn't always run the Derby on the first Saturday in May. As I told you on, On Friday. It must have been on Friday when we found those, there were those three derbies from May 8th from before World War II that included very prominent. Regret won it on the 8th and War Admiral won it on the 8th. And actually a horse that figures into our next conversation, Paul Jones, won that 1920 derby on a May 8th. Well, on May 11th, 1918, I think before the pandemic had started to really hammer away at the population, Exterminator put the spurs to his incredible Hall of Fame career. Eliza McGraw detailed it about 5 years ago, and here comes Exterminator. And Eliza, it's great to have you back. Good morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
I was thinking this morning, and I had the, you know, the Derby Media Guide that's been producing, you know, some really fun conversations, Carl Nafsker and Bill Boland, and just have had, you know, these sort of looks back. And when I saw that Exterminator had won on May 11th, 1918, I said, I got to get Eliza McGraw back. For a bunch of reasons, there's plenty of people listening that didn't hear you 5 years ago when you visited, and we celebrated the release of the book. And in addition, we got to find out, you know, what you've been working on and what's next. But, you know, first of all, I got a kick out of your response to my inquiry when I said, you know, Casey will call you from the 954, and you say, "Well, I'll be here." That's everybody right now.
Right. That is very true. We are here. Luckily, doing okay in my household, but definitely here.
Well, for writers, it's funny. Dave Hill, whose own book, The Vapors, about Hot Springs, is coming out in June, July. He wrote about being at home and being, you know, working as a writer at home. It at least for you, it's not a, you know, it's not a situation that I imagine it inhibits. I mean, what you do anyway. I mean, the rest before we had to deal with this.
Well, it's funny, I read that same thing. I love reading Dave Hill. I think he's terrific. And one of the things he wrote about in that I think it's that same newsletter that you're talking about, was about Laura Hillenbrand,
yep,
writing and being truly trapped.
Yes.
So in my family, the joke is always if mom's not at the barn, she's at the library. Like, these are the two places I can pretty much be, you know, I'm either at the Library of Congress or out with my own horse or something like that. But otherwise, you're absolutely right, you know, I'm here. But the way that Dave wrote about, okay, so two more, right? So the way Dave wrote about Hillenbrand and her breadth of research from being at home like that, I think is such an important way to think about what we do. And I loved his newsletter and his essay. And, you know, that idea that, especially when you're writing about racing history or any kind of history, that you, if you have the time and space to do it, that you really read deeply, you know, not just about the thing that you're reading. And that kind of goes back to what you were saying about, you know, the pandemic that was going on during the 1918 Derby. You know, there wasn't just one news story at the time.
there was so much about the last several days, and so many of the, you know, so many of the prominent racing historians and people mm-hmm. that have written books of late. Did you see Dorothy Auer's piece about Paul Jones and about Man of War skipping the Derby the other day in the Courier Journal?
No, I didn't. I'll have to check that out, though. She's terrific.
And it's just funny because it really struck me because Paul Jones, you know, who's, you know, one of those, you know, one of those Derby winners that is mentioned only in concert with Man of War having not shipped to Churchill and missing his chance to be included. Right. I mean, that, however, for you, when you researched Here Comes Exterminator, Paul Jones and Exterminator, how many times did they run against each other down the road?
That is something I would have had to look up, but he was very famously, you know, when Exterminator was starting to flag, Paul Jones became a bit of a symbol in his career because he was so young and strong and fast, and he was certainly a horse that showed that Exterminator was getting a little bit old, you know, before his sort of resurgence and comeback. You know, Paul Jones, he was a big deal, and you're right, he sort of gets forgotten and put next to other horses, but you know, he was there, you know, in Maryland waiting for Exterminator quite a bit, and he was his own story too. So I can't wait to read that, what Dorothy Orr's has written.
There's a race in Exterminator's career, and you know, we'll circle back to the Derby and you know how it in itself is a pretty remarkable story. But when you look at the 100 starts and you think to yourself in 1923,
mm-hmm.
5 years after Exterminator wins the Derby and 3 years after Paul Jones had won a Derby, the two of them meet the last time when one of them was to win, and that was in the Philadelphia Handicap. It ended up being Exterminator's last win. Exterminator carrying 129 pounds to Paul Jones's 109, and he decisions him by a neck. And, you know, here they are, 3 and 5 years removed from their Derbies. I mean, if that happened today, if there were Derby winners running this long after their Derby wins, I mean, it would be it's just so unheard of and so crazy to look back 100 years and see this.
It is, and it's to your point about, you know, these sort of titanic figures. I mean, they are larger than life, and when you, you know, put it in context like that, we can't help but see them that way because they're doing things that we would not imagine are even possible. I mean, you see how they became these sort of big figures that people like me end up wanting to write books about.
And let's revisit that, and we'll sort of boot the whole conversation, you know, back to, frankly, probably the one we had 5 years ago. But how did Exterminator catch your interest anyway?
So Exterminator caught my interest when I was working on a story for Mid-Atlantic Thoroughbred about the remount. There's a remount station in Front Royal, Virginia, and I was writing about some people who had rallied to preserve that as a historic site. And it was all around the same time period, of course, and so when I started researching, Exterminator's name kept coming up over and over again to kind of circle back again to Dave Hill and Hillenbrand and that sort of, you know, when you read across the time period that you're writing about. And I remembered Exterminator from Old Bones the Wonder Horse, of course, which is a very beloved children's book and for any horse crazy kid, you know, a staple. And then I just got more and more excited because I hadn't realized that he'd done things like, you know, beat another Derby winner in the Philadelphia Handicap or run, you know, winning 50 races. And, you know, I didn't know about the 30-1 and all the things that I hadn't really focused on as a kid. You know, the story just kind of got fleshed out and got bigger and bigger. And then World War One, you know, he was a hero of a really important time. You know, and it's kind of obviously not as much as what happened to Paul Jones, but, you know, Exterminator got kind of shoved aside because of Man of War in the first place, because, you know, anybody in those days and even writers like Red Smith and Grantland Rice would write about Exterminator the same way. But I think maybe because he was a gelding and, you know, maybe because he wasn't as predominant as Man of War, his name, we know you, when people would think about the great heroes of the World War One to the 20s, you know, it's pretty much Man of War's time. You know, he kind of stands out as the racehorse of that time. And so for many years, I think Exterminator was sort of in the shadow of that legend. And that was, you know, that's always exciting for a writer to think that there's going to be a way in which they can rediscover or sort of bring to light a story that might not have been told recently. And that's kind of what happened with me and Exterminator.
The research involved, and whether it, you know, whether it's newspapers.com and, you know, microfiche, and you mentioned, you know, the, you live in DC and the access to, you know, the Library of Congress, and I'm sure the Keeneland Library and the various research, and
For racing history, I mean, the Keeneland Library, I mean, what a priceless, amazing, you know, place. Like, there's the National Sporting Library, which is not too far from me here in Middleburg, also amazing. And then the Daily Racing Form archives are invaluable. I often think that, you know, historians who aren't writing about racing would do well to spend time in those archives, because they're beautifully done. And they're so expansive, and racing writers wrote about other stuff. You know, it's a really important contextual thing. But so horse racing and horse sports in general have some pretty dedicated archivists that make it easier for us, for sure.
And of course, there's also the fascinating tangent, the obscurity as to Binghamton, New York, that is germane to, you know, to the work and to Here Comes Exterminator.
Oh yeah, and they've got the Broome County Historical Society, with which I became intimately familiar. And then there's a website, you know, some of your New Yorkers might know, called Fulton Newspapers, also out of New York, but that is an individual. I think it's somebody who just got a hold of a lot of microfilm and microfiche, and that has a ton of stuff from Binghamton. And of course, you know, one of the wild things about the Exterminator story is that Exterminator's owner, Willis Sharp Kilmer, also owned the Binghamton newspaper. So there was a ton of coverage. That was just a goldmine of Exterminator's day-to-day, you know, life, or how he felt when he was getting on a train, or truly down to sometimes what he'd eaten. So you're right. It all has to do with like what research you wind up with. And I, you know, Josh Pons, I mean, one of our greatest racing writers and writing about history, you know, has incredible, ways that he actually, I think, does some of the best work in terms of writing about researching, about how history comes alive, you know, in archives or boxes of letters or photographs that you might find. You know, he's the one who found those never before seen pictures of Man of War as a baby, you know, and it's just incredible contribution to this whole world.
You talk about Man of War, and I was going to figure him in to the discussion, because with all the various stars of the era that Exterminator faced and more or less had rivalries with, it's in some ways a real who's who. I mean, we mentioned Paul Jones, but Gray Lag and Billy Kelly and Mad Hatter, Sir Barton beat him in the Saratoga Handicap in 1920. You look up and down here, there's names from, you know, the sports history from that era that are really notable. The Porter as well. And, you know, anybody that got any weight. I mean, one of the things that's amazing is when you see him literally, Exterminator, carrying 30 pounds above a rival.
I
mean, it was commonplace then. I mean, in this day and age, every trainer would scratch. It would say, "No, thank you. We're not taken that way."
But it was commonplace for him. But I mean, that's how he got all those wild nicknames. Like, that's why they called him the Big Train and the Iron Horse. Because, you know, it wasn't every horse that got saddled with that much. But, you know, yeah, he did not. Mostly his trainers did not back down, and he would run with that weight. And it was just astonishing, especially, you know, how he would win with that weight. You know, when he beat Gray Lag in the Brooklyn in 1922, he was carrying so much more weight. He was so much older. I mean, again, it's just, you know, it's of course easy for me because I have stars in my eyes when it comes to Exterminator. But I mean, that was a really big horse and a big deal. And he was something special and worth the, you know, crowds that thronged to see him and stuff. I think it was a worthwhile sort of star.
When you talk about the way in which things kind of came together, it's interesting because from being bred to being bought to then being, you know, sold to the connections that ended up, you know, enjoying the breadth of his career, and even the fact that he wasn't even the primary interest of McDaniel and Kilmer when it came to the Derby that year. Talk about, you know, how he even came to be involved. He ends up going off at 30-1.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that is, it's one of those stories that even at the time it was called, you know, the Cinderella story, or, you know, it's just that sort of classic underdog story that is so much interest in racing. And when I was a kid, it was Swale and Devil's Bag that had sort of been the story. But yeah, for Kilmer and McDaniel, they had, going into the Derby, they had the prime two-year-old, you know, the juvenile champion, Sunbriar, who was a huge deal and just an incredible racehorse himself. And he'd been the, you know, champion at Saratoga. And he was pretty much the Derby favorite, you know, by January. I mean, he was very well known and, you know, was going to be shipping to Louisville. But when he got there, McDaniel, who was, you know, an incredible trainer and just had, you know, forgotten more about horses than most people will ever know, was trying everything he could do, but he didn't have him back in juvenile form. He just was not the horse he had been as a three-year-old, and he couldn't figure it out. He had ring bones, but that hadn't been a problem. They were high up. They didn't bother him. And he wasn't necessarily lame, but he couldn't sort of train the way that he had before. And McDaniel, you know, the reporters in those days, you know, they were hanging on the rail and they were watching everything. And so there's wonderful detail about, you know, one day Sunbriar would come out in blinkers and the next day he'd come out with a different exercise rider. And then the next day he'd have a different training partner, and just everybody watching, you know, McDaniel try to solve this horse. And he decided that the training partner, that Sunbriar really did run better if he had a good training partner to kind of make him go to simulate maybe, you know, some more competition. And he bought Exterminator to be a training partner. He bought him as what they called a truck horse, you know, just to sort of make Sunbriar go. But McDaniel liked him from the minute he saw him. But he was, the one thing about Exterminator, and this was always, you know, part of why he got his nickname Old Bones and stuff, is that he was a little funny looking. He, you know, as big as he was, and as we look at pictures of him, we can see why he was such a great weight carrier conformationally, but he had big ears and he had a very funny way of walking, like in full flight, you know, he was a real racehorse looking, but, you know, people called him Abe Lincoln or said he looked like, you know, he should be hitched to a buggy. You know, he was not a very forceful presence when you first saw him compared to Sunbriar, who really was very regal. So even on the surface, this like sort of underdog thing happened. But he had been nominated to the Derby. He was eligible. And as the days and weeks went on and Sunbriar just couldn't call himself back, and McDaniel was doing everything he could, and Exterminator was looking better and better and better. And Kilmer was famously temperamental, and McDaniel was scared in a way to tell Kilmer, like, we can't run Sunbriar. Like, it's not right. You know, he's not himself, and he's not going to do well. And he had to work up his courage not only to tell his boss that his, you know, favorite was not going to be able to run in the Derby, but that he wanted to run Exterminator instead. And by all accounts, when McDaniel told Kelmer this, he exploded, and he said things like, you know, I would sooner send that horse to the livery stable than to the start in the Derby. And, you know, you've bought me a billy goat. I mean, this is not, you know, he was beside himself. So Matt Wynn, who's, you know, sort of known as the father of the Kentucky Derby. And if you go to the museum now, they have his chair, and really gives you an idea of sort of the importance of Wynn and his opinion. And it was Wynn who said, you know, I would listen to Henry McDaniel. I would go ahead and run Exterminator. And that is what convinced Kelmer to do it. And he did want to see, he had all these people coming down from Binghamton, and he was really sad. I mean, he really wanted to see his colors in the Derby. So, you know, the other thing you mentioned, the sort of context of history, is that it was this World War I Derby, and racing was at a high of patriotism because it was linked very much to the cavalry. And racing had worked really hard to make sure that people understood that link. And it was Wynn was bound that this was going to be the most patriotic Derby. And so it was really the right thing for Kelmer to do, you know, to run his horse. So, but Exterminator went off at 30-1. I mean, there were major favorites in that race. There was Viva America. There were War Cloud. They all, you know, sort of had these, you know, really patriotic names. Spirits were really running high. And, Exterminator was running, but really not expected to win. He was the 5 horse, and he went off at 30-1. It was raining. So, you know, it's great. We actually have film from that day, and I encourage everybody to look that up because it's pretty fun to watch them splashing. And he won. And when the race was over, people looked out at their programs, so they were like, who was that? Like, who was even the 5 horse? No one even knew until later when McDaniel wrote about it. He said it was the quietest Derby, because there wasn't a roar of applause, you know, right after the race. There wasn't cheering and whistling and stamping the way you would have thought. And in the years to come, you know, when all Exterminator had to do was walk onto a, you know, racetrack to get that kind of encore, you know, people talked back to that was the last time, you know, that it was ever quiet for him, was that 1918 Derby when he had done the impossible, you know, and won the race. That was probably a little longer than you needed, but my favorite story.
No, that was fine. Well, that was great. And you mentioned Matt Wynn, and I'm glad you brought up that, you know, that element of the story. Did you have access to the Matt Wynn, you know, as told to biography down the stretch?
Yes, love that.
Well, because he specifically in chapter 13, he. Greatest Thoroughbred. He writes extensively about up to the point, you know, that this has probably got to be, obviously it's before, you know, before he passed, and he saw the first 75 Derbies. He cites Exterminator as the greatest Thoroughbred, and this I think goes into the 40s actually. So this includes some pretty prominent 1945, and so, you know, you get to Whirl Away, clearly, you know, for Matt Wynn, to him it's Exterminator, and he writes glowingly.
He does. And I mean, those two are, you know, they're really linked forever because of that early faith, you know, that Wynn, I mean, Wynn was also, it wasn't just his faith in Exterminator, but it was his faith in McDaniel, you know, who was not a showboater and kind of was the sort of stereotype of the quiet, you know, horse trainer. But, you know, it was Wynn's confidence in him too. And yeah, just the glowing way that he writes about Exterminator definitely, I think, is representative of, you know, someone who knew horses and knew what was going on. But just, I think that's the part I always, you know, just wish so much I could have ever seen him in person, because the effect that Exterminator had on people is, you know, not very ordinary. You see why people kind of wax so poetic about him.
There's so much. That when you look through the career and the versatility and you know his ability to win a sprint, to win two and a quarter miles. I mean, he it's just a unbelievable sequence, and any kind of track, he literally, you know, he literally globetrotted to all the, you know, all the ovals, and there's so many that are gone from the, you know, gone from the landscape when you look through. Then there's some that are coming back, like Latonia,
right?
Which actually is the site of that's a site of a lot of his big wins.
Yeah, and that's pretty. Yeah, the thought of the sort of renaissance of that is really exciting.
He also, you know, I'm just looking at the, I'm just looking actually at the value of races, and the, you know, the Derby was 18,000 that year, and that may have been, as it happens, despite him accruing a quarter of a million, that was the big, was that the biggest? Yeah, I think it is. I think that's the biggest purse he ran for.
I think that's
right. Nah, Washington handicap. Yeah, the Washington handicap at Laurel would have been 28,000, which was a mammoth purse then.
Right.
That's 1922. Holy cow, that's a big purse. The Independence, here we go. The Independence handicap actually at Latonia, a $19,000 purse. So that was the biggest financial win of his career. But it's an amazing list, Eliza. And, you know, then the races that he would win repeatedly, like the what is now the Jockey Club Gold Cup, but you know then it was the Autumn Gold Cup, the Toronto Autumn Cup, the mm-hmm. Ontario Jockey Club, the Pimlico Cup. I mean, he won those handicap division races. I mean, just over and over again in some cases.
Well, that I mean, for anybody that. You know, it's so worthwhile when you're at Saratoga to go to the National Museum of Racing. And, you know, they helped me also. They've got exterminator material there. But to walk in and see his four Saratoga Cups in that case is really one of the most, I mean, you're just, it's a rather awe-inspiring, you know, the way they've got it set up. They're sort of purposely laid out, and you just stand before them and think, this is rather amazing. Like, this horse won all of these. You know, four times. I mean, that's a lot. And they, you know, they joked about it because it was during Prohibition that Exterminator was a cup horse because he won all those handicaps. And they said that, you know, it was ironic that it was during Prohibition because Exterminator was always in his cups.
That's cute. You know, he also, in terms of historic events that came, you know, years later, a very famous walkover, the Saratoga Cup in 1921.
Right.
There's only been a handful of walkovers. And he had that race at Hawthorne, the race against time. And he was pretty long in the tooth at that point.
Well, you know, it's funny because that's the whole debate over the whether you call it 100 races or 99. So that exhibition race at Hawthorne was counted for a long time, and you know, people would say 100 races, and then when Eva Boyd wrote the champion's biography of Exterminator for the old that series that they used to have, and that's a terrific book. She decided it should be 99 because that wasn't really a race, but. You know, I think 100 has like a nice symmetry to it, but that Hawthorne moment was certainly one of the biggest times to show what he meant to Americans because they poured out to see him that day at Hawthorne. Even when he was just standing in the stall, they had a big line just to walk by and see him.
Unbelievable. What kind of a horse was he to be around? Talk a little bit about the disposition. You know, when you got a, you know, veteran gelding like this, you know, that people want to see.
They do. And so I think he was always, you know, he always was associated with the war and with language that is very, you know, he was a campaigner. He was an old soldier. He was our general, you know, and I think that, like you said, you know, having an old gelding like that around, even just around, you know, anybody who's been around just a regular barn, there is a certain demeanor and a certain been there, done that kind of disposition that he had even as a young horse. And the Mars Cassidy said that Exterminator was the best assistant starter he ever had, because when the horses were lining up, you know, this is before starting gate, so it's kind of chaos and they're all kind of moiling around. If Exterminator got impatient, he would sort of lean on the horse next to him. You know, he would take on the sort of herd control and settle things down in a way that Cassidy, you know, alluded to. And he also, one of the things that people commented on was when he and McDaniel were together, he was really friendly. I mean, McDaniel carried sugar in one of the pockets of his overcoat, and reporters said that, you know, Exterminator would sort of march right up to him and put his head over his shoulder and, you know, look for that sugar. And then stick right with him. You know, those two were very close. And I think he was a friendly horse. And I think, you know, because he was a gelding, he wasn't particularly irascible, you know, and he was polite. And he had this one move that people said looked like a circus horse. So he would kind of, when he was walking by a big crowd, he would kind of, I think there's a picture of it when he was at Pimlico when he's much older, but he kind of would, it almost like a circus horse bows, you know, when they stick out their leg really straight and bow their head down. He had this like thing that he would, it seemed to people as if he knew when he was being acknowledged.
Like Zenyatta. That's the Zenyatta dance.
Yeah. Like, you know, there's just those uncanny things about horses that you can't swear that they know, but it felt like they did.
There's so much in the story, and you know, particularly Eliza, because of what, you know, of what is going on with the pandemic, and so with that backdrop, it to me was a natural to reach out to you, and people can order, you know, it's still available, obviously, and Here Comes Exterminator. If you didn't get it the first time around, and you know, there's always a half a dozen, you know, new books that come, this is, you know, this is such a terrific area for writers that it's amazing how many stories there are, you know, yet to be told. What have you been working on? Is there something new in the works?
Well, right now, I am actually working on not as much racing stuff, but I did write a story about Elizabeth Dangerfield for the Blood Horse, and she was a more, you know, she took care of Man of War when he went to stud. And so that was something that I really enjoyed. But I think that now I'm thinking it's time to get into Paul Jones, clearly. I think you're
Why
right.
Not?
It's a really rich world for anyone writing, just because the stories are there. And then I just have to say, talking about David Hill and Laura Hill and Brandon Josh Pons, it's an incredible world of writing. You know, these are all current, you know, people and Dorothy. But when you get back, especially into the Exterminator time, the turf writers of that era really were storytellers, you know, and there's a question of like whether it was really the golden age of racing or just the golden age of turf writing. And I think there have been many, many golden ages and many wonderful turf writers, but the language of racing history is, I just think it's unrivaled in terms of reading. So I encourage everybody to go back.
Well, Here Comes Exterminator, The Long Shot Horse, The Great War, and The Making of an American Hero, Eliza McGraw. And I'll send out links to any number of the places where you could order it. If you haven't read it yet, I highly encouraged. And of course, I haven't looked at it since, you know, 5 years ago when we first talked, but it was 102 years ago today that Exterminator and Willie Knapp were winners at 30-1, one of the nice prices in the Derby. And it was, of course, Donerail that you know, had the biggest price for a long, long time. And 30-1 is a, that's right. That's right. That's why I completely forgotten that.
Yeah.
I completely forgotten that. So between the two of them,
I know.
Between the two of them, they average 60-1 between the, that's absolutely. I love it. Too funny. Yeah. Eliza, this was as much fun as it was the first time.
I know. Thank you so much for having me on. It makes me so happy to think about people thinking about that anniversary today. And I really appreciate you taking the time.
Not at all. We appreciate getting to you. And Eliza McGraw's Here Comes Exterminator. If it's not on your shelf already, come on. I'll send you the link and you'll have one by Wednesday or Thursday, seeing as how everybody's getting a chance to do things like read that they may have forgotten how to do before this whole thing started.
Right.
Eliza, be well, stay safe, and we'll be watching for the next thing you write.
Thanks so much, Steve. I really appreciate it. You stay well too.
No. Eliza McGraw, everybody. You can follow Eliza on Twitter. It's Eliza, E-L-I-Z-A, McGraw, like Tug, M-C-G-R-A-W, Eliza McGraw. Let's take a break. Our last of the morning. Got to get John White in here, see how John's been keeping busy. And John wants to be busy, hoping that Santa Anita gets open on Friday. They're going to draw tomorrow and hope for the best. And actually, I heard from Hammer, and some of the things that we talked about right at the beginning of the show may not be an issue. They say that Hammer's hearing that a concern about a worker on Track Kitchen, that was false, that there isn't, that that's not a problem. So that's good news. So we're just, you know, just waiting on the okay, and you know, everybody's still very upbeat and hopeful that it's going to come. So they'll draw a card tomorrow, and John will be waiting to make selections and put the morning line together. John White closes out the Monday get-together after this.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
If you are racing two-year-olds in California, Kentucky, please consider Bleeder Shield. The leading all-natural paste used to greatly reduce or eliminate EIPH. The list of trainers who trust Bleeder Shield is endless. Shouldn't you join the team? To learn more, contact Joseph Vellante at 215-501-6880.
Learn the business of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.
Here in Pennsylvania, we have the best breeding program in the country, thanks in part to our Racehorse Development Trust Fund. It's a trust, it's not tax dollars, and by law, our fund is completely protected. These are difficult days for all of us. When life in America gets back to normal, and it will, our PA breeding program will be here, stronger and better than ever. To learn more about how we're protecting the trust, go to PABred.com to watch a short video.
How's it going, Sue?
Hey!
Have you seen this commercial?
What career track are you on?
University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program can prepare you for an exciting career in racing. Turn your passion into a paycheck.
Isn't that the horse racing school that Bob Baffert went to?
Yeah, Todd Fletcher, too, and lots of other major players in every area of the industry.
Really? Like what?
Well, for starters, we have graduates who are executives at Churchill Downs, NYRA, Darley America, Gulfstream, Keeneland, you name it. They're also regulators, racing officials, bloodstock agents, track announcers. My class had a job placement rate of almost 90%.
Wow. What other college program has results like that?
What career track are you on? The University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program. Enroll today and get on track for success. Nearly 90% of our students are employed in the racing industry. industry immediately upon graduation. For scholarship opportunities and more, check out our website at ua-rtip.org.
Now, back to At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
We're back, just about 20 minutes to close out Monday, and ended up being a fuller morning than you expect. It's pretty crazy, even without the racing, the heavy racing schedule. But Eric Zimney and Johnny and Eliza McGraw just now to talk about Here Comes Exterminator. And John White joins us. John, good morning.
Good morning. I've certainly enjoyed this walk down Derby memory lane that you've had for the last week or so. It's been absolutely just so much fun. And this particular case with Exterminator, I've really been enjoying watching the Ken Burns documentary on the Roosevelt. So that's from that same era of Exterminator. And when you look at Exterminator, I mean, he won from 5.5 furlongs to 2.25 miles. So not only did he have the longevity to race to a 9-year-old and win 50 races, but he had that kind of versatility, and you were discussing his tremendous weight-carrying ability. He was a very popular horse, too. In fact, Blood Horse Magazine in 1999 came out with their list of the top 100 racehorses of the 20th century, Jay Hovday among a very distinguished panel that put together that list. Man of War topped the list, which I agree with. Secretariat was second. Exterminator ranked 29th, and inspired by that Blood Horse list, for the last many years, I've put together my own list of the top 100 racehorses of the 20th and 21st centuries to have raced in North America. And even though I've added quite a number of horses from this century to my top 100, horses like American Pharoah and Justify, Zenyatta, Sunday Silent, Cigar, that weren't on the Blood Horse list, I should say Zenyatta, American Pharoah, and Justify, as Sunday Silence and Cigar were on the Blood Horse list, but I've, you know, had to make room for these horses from this century, and even taking that into consideration, I have Exterminator ranked 27th on my list, which is higher than the Blood Horse does on their list. That's the kind of respect I give Exterminator. And, you know, there's this controversy whether he made 100 starts of 150 races or whether one of his races was a workout. And what I think has been misconstrued by those saying he made 99 career starts, back in those days, they actually did have races in which one of a top horse would race against time. It wasn't a workout. It was a race because this was before Prairie Mutual betting. And bookmakers would post, they'd have a time posted, and you could bet like the over and under on the time, whether the horse would break the time that was put up for the horse. For instance, in the tremendous book by William Robertson, The History of Thoroughbred Racing in America, during that Exterminator time, he talked about Sunbriar running a mile in 136 and 1/5, which was the fastest mile ever run in actual competition, as distinguished from Romer's record of 134 and 4, which had been set in a race against time. So, see, there's a reference to this race against time. And if you look at Exterminator's record in the Daily Racing Form past performances in the book Champions, it says race against time, not workout, race against time. So it actually was a race. Yeah. That's why it was always considered that he made 100 career starts and not this. All of a sudden now, all these years later, it's been this controversy, well, actually he made 99 because one of those was actually a workout. Well, no, it actually was a race against time.
And for those that are saying, well, how far did he go and how fast did he go? He went the 1.25 in 2:10. And I'm just looking at the variant, John, and it looks like the track was slow, right?
Yeah.
So the track was rated 73, and they say good run. I mean, and if he got paid for it, if it was a quote unquote exhibition.
One of the reasons why they're saying it wasn't a race, because evidently there was no purse. But again, so you would say, well, why would they even run him in this so-called race if there was no purse? Well, the reason is because people were betting, and even the owners a lot of time would be betting. In other words, back then you had these owners that were big-time bettors, you know, like the Dwyer brothers and so forth, that were very famous in terms of huge scores in gambling. So it didn't necessarily have to have a purse in those days to be considered a race. I mean, it's a quirky thing because I wonder when the last time in North America a horse did run, you know, have a race against time. But it kind of reminds me of Spectacular Bid's walkover in a way, you know, but that was a walkover. But even that's considered a race by him because it was a walkover. And Shoemaker was on him that day, and he actually went pretty quick by himself. They actually let him, you know, it wasn't like an all-out drive or anything, but it was kind of like a really public workout, and he posted a very good time for the mile and a quarter in that walkover.
And it's funny, even the notation for him in Exterminator's walkover, which came in the 1921 Saratoga Cup, the notation is galloped. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Well, of course, he galloped mile and three quarters over the slow going in 3 minutes and 4 seconds and 3/5. And
I remember
compare
Hatton,
that actually. Let's see.
I remember Hatton writing about these. You know, some he would allude from time to time in his tremendous writings about a horse in a race against time, and that's where that resonated with me, you know, going back to remembering reading that from Hatton.
It's an amazing career, and I, as I mentioned, now that I took it off the shelf for today's, you know, Derby memory, I'm going to have to reread it or at least re-skim and refamiliarize, because there were some things that I'd forgotten that he was Donerail's brother. But it's an amazing career.
And by the way, that same year he won the Derby in that upset on the muddy track, there were two divisions of the Preakness that year, and that's the only time in Triple Crown history that there were two divisions of one of the three Triple Crown races. They split the Preakness that year.
How about that? And he did not continue on. From the Derby, he actually ran in the Latonia Derby, and he ran in the Kenner Stakes at Saratoga, which was a big race at the time. And then the Travers didn't run well in the Travers actually at all. And his stablemate Sunbrier actually that was Sunbrier's opportunity, and he also ran in the Turf and Field Handicap, but he did not, you know, he Derby was May 11th, and not sure, was the Preakness before?
No,
the Preakness might have been before
May
that 15th year.
Was the Preakness,
so it was barely time to get a train to come back to Baltimore.
And then a month to the
no wonder there were so few Triple Crown winners, right?
Well, then they had a month to the Belmont. And the horse that did the best in that Triple Crown was War Cloud, because he finished fourth to Exterminator in the Derby, won a division of the Preakness, and then ran second in the Belmont. So, like, if you were giving a points total, he would have been the one that would have come out of it with the most points.
Well, John, a couple of thoughts here for what's been going on. And as I mentioned, you know, we're still, and you're part of the, you know, the Santa Anita team that's just waiting for this, you know, for this okay for the health department to, you know, give the go ahead. They're going to draw a card tomorrow, and we're hoping for the best. Anything, you know, what else have you heard? Any news to impart?
That's exactly the situation. You put it perfectly. I mean, that's all I know is as of right now, I mean, and this is such a fluid situation, it seems, but I mean, at this point, they are taking entries tomorrow, and for the Friday card, of course, they put out the condition book for this period of time, and so we'll just have to wait and see. I mean, we're just very cautiously optimistic, is I guess the best you can put it at this point. But one thing that worries me is that, you know, like only last night on the news, I saw these states that are called hot, you know, the hottest states, and California is one of them. And then Los Angeles County in the state of California is like one of the real hot spots. And so that makes me a little nervous, too, in terms of there's so much of this hinging on these numbers, and the numbers aren't really too good for Los Angeles County, even at this point. So that has me a bit concerned. But, you know, the thing is I don't really know why Santa Anita never was able to continue running in the first place when you have the Arboretum across the street that has never ceased operation, and that is owned by Los Angeles County or operated by Los Angeles County. And then you have Orange County right next door to Los Angeles County, and Los Alamitos has gone on without a hitch. So, I mean, this is again, what kind of makes me nervous, because, it makes you worried that there's more to this than just the virus going on. But, I mean, Santa Anita, as I said on your show recently, I mean, Aiden Butler has just done a fabulous job in terms of coordinating this presentation to the Board of Supervisors, the County Board of Supervisors, and to the Health Board. And, I mean, they have dotted every I, crossed every T. I mean, they've gone far beyond places like Oaklawn Park and Gulfstream and these places that have been running in terms of the protocols that they're saying Santa Anita is going to implement. So, I mean, they know that they want to give every opportunity, you know, that they can to not let them say no. So, you know, and that's the thing that's been a little frustrating, too, is when they were first shut down, they weren't even necessarily, they were told they were a non-essential business. That was, but again, so why does Los Alamitos get to run? I mean, what, Los Alamitos is an essential business, but Santa Anita isn't? I mean, there's this lack of uniformity in how a lot of these things have been implemented, and so we just, a lot of fingers are being crossed right now, and a lot of people are holding their breath, hoping that, because we sure would like to see the Great Race Place back in action this Friday, that is for sure.
Well, no doubt, and the, you know, plus with the revised stake schedule set the way, you know, set the way it has in anticipation of rebooting the season and getting going again. You know, that part, I just feel terrible for everybody that, you know, is trying to maintain, you know, the horses toward, you know, constantly readjusted goals. And
yep.
You know, part of it, you know, certain opportunities were targeted and then traveled, you know, difficulties and some of the restrictions that were going to be, you know, placed on personnel being able to travel with horses. I mean, frankly, John, it's really remarkable how many horses were even able to get to places like Oaklawn to compete.
Yeah.
In the stakes down the last, you know, the last three, four weeks of the, you know, of the Oaklawn season. It's been tough on everybody. No doubt.
I look at the last couple of mornings at Santa Anita, and I mean, the mouth waters with what we've seen on the work tab. Like Authentic worked yesterday for Baffert, worked very nicely. Bella Fina had just a marvelous workout for Simon Callahan, and is scheduled to run this weekend at this point if we do race. So, I mean, that's right there, something to look forward to. We had the 1-2 finishers from that exciting Apple Blossom Handicap at Oaklawn. CC and Ollie's Candy both work and work very well on Saturday. Flagstaff, who ran that good second after the bad start in the Count Fleet at Oaklawn, he had a sharp workout yesterday, Saturday, 47 and change. McKenzie, who looks like maybe he's back in good form after the disappointing effort. in the Saudi Cup. He had a very good team drill with Dressman and 47 and change and did it very comfortably. So that's an encouraging sign. Improbable just looked terrific in a 6-furlong drill and 112 and change, which is really a fast work the way this track is right now. So you see all these, you know, big names on the work tabs, and you just say, my gosh, I certainly hope these horses, you know, get the opportunity to race.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, meanwhile, we've got three venues starting over the next week between Thursday, Golden Gate, and Charlestown, and then Saturday, Churchill. So let's get this card drawn tomorrow and just get that okay and get going.
Yep, hopefully so. Like I say, fingers crossed, and we're holding our breath and hoping for the best.
John White, everybody, and let's get going, huh? Right, Santa Anita, get them going.
Who's your Derby horse tomorrow?
We may have to transition tomorrow. We may have to transition to Preakness tomorrow, and I'm hoping Daryl McArg is going to join us, and we could talk about Master Derby. How about that?
That'd be great. And we if you do get him, ask him about Hot and Nasty, who got closer to Ruffian than any filly in history in the sorority at Monmouth. So Daryl McCarg was the jockey that finished the closest to the Great Ruffian in terms of being on a filly in the career of Ruffian.
Well, and I only would be able to come up with two tomorrow on the Derby front because May 12th, which is my brother's birthday, as well as Chuck Simon's birthday, everybody. Wish Chuck a happy birthday. Omer Khayyam in 1917 won the Derby, and so did Typhoon the second. In 1897, those were the only two May 12ths. The latest Derby ever goes as far into May as what, the 23rd? Is that, I think so. I think May 23rd. Or no, June 9th. That's right. Hoop Jr. In the war during, in 45. That's right. So there's your latest. John, thanks. I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Steve. Take care.
John White, Eliza McGraw earlier. Here comes Exterminator. We'll send you links so you can buy one for yourself. Johnny D, Eric Zimney from Charlestown, that kicks off on Thursday. Tomorrow, we're looking for Daryl McCark. I think we're going to get Daryl tomorrow. I think Hedley Bell to pay tribute to Alice Chandler and... for getting into the hall. So some more Hall of Fame coverage tomorrow. Andy Serling as well, and more. Good luck if you're playing today, everybody. Foner and Will Rogers. Talk to you in the morning.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
If you are racing two-year-olds in California, Kentucky, please consider Bleeder Shield. The leading all-natural paste used to greatly reduce or eliminate EIPA.